there to a church across the railroad track from the school. And they had
power of resilient citizens.
Okay. They had we had one of the voter registration matters at a church, rural church. I mean really rural church, on a dead end road. Bob Moses was driving Andrew Moore's old Packer. And by the time the meeting was over, somebody came in back, and we had these lookouts out there. One of the lookouts came in and told us that the police some white folks had blocked the one road out of there had been blocked. And these guys were sitting on the hood of a car with shotguns at their hands. And I had been in one of these situations before, Bob Moses. You know, he's one of these guys that was always a mystic, who wanted to drive up there and negotiate with these guys. I said, Bob, I'll drive up there, but I'm not going to negotiate. I'm going to try to run this damn barricade. And if I don't get to drive, I'm not going up there. I'm going to walk. I'm walking out of here because there's one guy up here, one of the lookouts had a shotgun. I said, hell, I'm walking on with this guy with a shotgun. No way I'm driving up here with you and surrender myself to these guys. So, you know, Bob and I had one of these real philosophical arguments, man. I said, man, shit, I'm not driving to surrender myself to these guys. You got to be crazy, man. So he finally agreed to let me drive the car, and I remember snaking my way through these guys. I remember snaking my way through these guys with this car on a dirt road while they were drinking. They apparently didn't have a weapon on them or something, but it was, that kind of stuff went on down there all the time, man. Shit, I was glad to get out of there. Harold, just push stop.
I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but one question I'm curious about is, I was talking with Joyce Latham last night about it, was sort of some of the philosophical divisions within the organization, how the different personalities fit into that. Lee Sellers has, you call it the floaters and the, what do you call it? The floaters and the pragmatists. Northern Southern Division and all of that. But I'm particularly interested, I guess, in your reaction to the influence that Moses had within the organization and the Foreman had.
Well, I think that if you're looking at it now, I mean, I would say that they played different roles. They were complementary to each other. And they played different roles. I mean, Foreman, it's kind of ironic because this happens many times in life. Bob Moses was born in New York, and he came to Mississippi and spent a lot of time organizing the rural area. Foreman was born in Mississippi and moved to Chicago, and he was always in the office. He almost never went out of the office. His view was that you had to have an organization which communicated between the people in the field and the public, and you had to find a way to bridge that, and he set up the office structure to do that with. And I think he always that was the way he operated. Bob was always better, I think, with people, and as a result, the major people outreach part of it, like the Summer Project, was put together primarily by Bob. I mean, Jim may have made the contacts, but it was Bob who persuaded all these people to come. His ability to persuade people on personal basis was much greater than Jim's. And some of it was because he was an intellectual on the one end, a Harvard grad, and on the other end, a kind of a mystic who was working in these rural areas and risking his life every day. You gotta remember now, you're talking about, I've described for you probably 50 incidents of just abject violence that would probably color most folks' lives for a long time. And it colored our lives too. So I think the roles were different. Bob, I think, was more philosophical in the sense that he was as I said, better able to relate one on one into small groups. Foreman was probably better at haranguing larger crowds and going out to the, as I said, reaching out to the world through the media, manipulating the media. and public opinion. And we needed that combination of people. And fortunately enough, they didn't come in contact with each other that much. Foreman had his gang of people who hung around the office and were in Atlanta and New York and Chicago and places like that. And Bob had a gang of folk who were in the South, in Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia, and who were the field organizers. And, you know, once or twice a year we got together in these meetings, and then you could see some of the differences. But, you know...
Did people like yourself and G. Cocker Allison look at him as sort of your representative when you would go to the big, like, the basement conference?
Bob? I think to some extent, yes. Although we, you know, we played our own role. We had, you know, we eventually got a rule passed that you couldn't vote in these meetings if you hadn't been in jail, because the people who played, the people who were sort of, well, what Foreman would do would be to go, because he did a lot of speaking around the North in these cities, he'd bring students to these meetings from, you know, the Stokely Carmichaels and people from Howard and Southern and all these places to these meetings, wanting them to have full, fair and full voting rights and dominate the meetings. There was some tension about that. We handled that by saying you couldn't. We handled it two ways. One, we didn't do anything we didn't want to do anyway. We were the guys who were out there on the streets. Right. And secondly, we finally got a rule passed that you couldn't vote if you hadn't been in jail, which took care of Stokely and that group, because most of them had were campus intellectuals. They were intellectual radicals. They weren't activists. And it forced them to become, that their reaction to that was to become more activists. And then in the summer of 64, many of them came south and, you know, Cortland, Stokely, and that's where Gene and I met, my wife and I, got involved, got arrested a lot. Okay.
You wouldn't call it your heart.
Well, okay. All right. Okay.
Have a good trip back. Okay.
Okay.
Take care. All right. Was there a... Do you think there was a class element to some of those things?
Well, I think there was a little of all. I mean, we had some of the same tensions that were in society. Sex, race, class. I think that there were some people who, there were people, let's put it this way, people were more comfortable working in the office than they were working in the fields. My view, and I think to some extent that reflected also, if you might call it a philosophical difference in organizing. I felt, and I think many of us in Mississippi felt, that you had to have a grassroots movement built up where people got some confidence in themselves and got familiar with each other, and then as they developed and evolved, you would have a eventually have a mass movement, and there was no doubt about that. We probably shared that concept with Martin Luther King, that you had to have a mass movement there in order to change the South. King just chose to go about it differently. He'd go into town with these hit and run deals, these big church mass meetings, and leave behind really the ministers and the existing organizations to sort of fair things out and push them through. We thought we had to build some people who understood and who by our example became brave and would be examples of leadership, provide leadership to other people. That was SNCC. I think there was a difference in SNCC and SCLC. Within SNCC itself, there were people who were more apt at doing that. And somebody like Ivanhoe Donaldson, Ivanhoe really spent most of his time in the office, except for a short time he spent in Holly Springs. There were some people who never went outside the office, stayed there all the time. But I think that and on the race side of it, I remember very distinctly when Bob first talked to us about the Summer Project at a meeting up in, I think it was in Greenville. The Mississippi staff met in Greenville to talk about the Summer Project, and we voted overwhelmingly against participating in it. And the argument basically was that we had just started to build these little organizations all over the state, and we had a lot of little baby organizations going on all over Mississippi, but we didn't have anything that was big enough to stand up under the onslaught of a lot of influx of people from the outside, especially white people. And Bob's view was that you had to put some light on this now, that we had just gotten, we were just losing too many people, and we were getting beaten up, and it was, you know, I think he was probably right, that we had taken a lot, and so we needed to have some way to bring in people, and that there were a lot of students, and a lot of, and he was hearing this from this guy, whose name I can't remember now, this white guy, Jewish guy, who,
Lowenstein,
Al, he was hearing from Al, who had a more global picture of America, and also was tracking to some extent some of the things that were going on in Congress. And so they concocted this idea about the, you know, about the Summer Project. And I think it probably I think if we hadn't started pushing to try to get the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party to, if we hadn't decided to focus on trying to put the parallel party together and a parallel organization and to force the issue of the Freedom Democratic Party at the 64th convention, we probably we may never have pulled off the Summer Project, because I think the way he finally got us interested in doing it, two ways. One, he literally cried, said he was going to quit because he thought we were racist and didn't want any white people involved. He wasn't going to be involved in an organization that liked no white people. And he would go 180 degrees on this, by the way, before he left Mississippi, eventually go to Africa because he didn't want to be bothered with white people anymore. But by his personal appeal and personal persuasion, he convinced us to reverse. Well, actually, we never did reverse ourselves. He just said, you got to do this.
But the idea of building the NDP was... made it more attractive.
Well, I made it more attractive because it focused us outward. I mean, you know, you were building a Freedom Democratic Party because you couldn't. And also, I guess in a way, from my point of view, man, this is looking back, and I've never thought about it quite this way, but I'm sure it's the case, that we were going nowhere with the voter registration business the way we were doing it. I mean, you know, you take some guy, you get one guy registered to vote in Panola County, and three up in so-and-so, and 10 somewhere else. Symbolically, it was important, but you were never going to get anybody, enough people registered to vote to make any difference in any of these counties. And so we were really going nowhere with that. And, you know, I remember I had advanced at the SNCC meeting in, I think this was in the fall of 63, that I thought that the SNCC should come out squarely against the literacy test. I thought it was something that was a thing of the past, it belonged to the horse and buggy age, and besides, you couldn't pass a test that the giver didn't want you to pass. And there was just no way to pass a subjective test that the administrator who was administering the test didn't want you to pass. And I thought we were deceiving ourselves and just wasting our time and money. So,
what was the reaction to that?
Well, I tell Foreman this all the time. Foreman said he thought I was crazy. He said, look, this guy's obviously been in the city too long. He needs R&R. There's a sacred view in this country that a person got to know how to read and write before they can vote. He was right about that, but he didn't remember the fact that America changed since the goddamn horse and buggy age. That people had television and newspapers and radios. And, you know, you could learn everything you need to know about a candidate without even picking up a newspaper or without picking up his resume. And times have changed, and people being kept from voting because people using these things ways people from registering to vote, denying their rights. And we had to face that, and we were going to ever get nowhere with it. And, you know, eventually, of course, in a couple of years, Congress passed a law banning the damn literacy test and the poll tax.
Right.
But that was a major thing for us, because I think focusing, as I said once again, on the Freedom Democratic Party gave us a chance to examine all this stuff, to look outward. And you know, in the long run, I'm sure it made a lot of difference. There's no question about the fact that the Voting Rights Act just changed the South. More than school integration or integrating lunch counters, I think the Voting Rights Act was really the one thing that eventually would change the South. because it changed the way people had to look at who their voters were. And it put the threat of political power there, even if it never was realized. The fact is that if you ever got people registered enough to vote, they could take over a county or a city. And they have done it in the hundreds of cases down there. And it's made a difference in the quality of life. That, together with other things, school integration and you know, lunch counter integration, things that made a lot of difference. But I would say, if you were talking about those three things on any kind of a weight basis, the most significant one was the right vote.
That's the last question. How did you feel over the course of time about Aaron Henry?
Well, there were several people out in Mississippi that were bigger than life. And I said, Emily was the first person I met when I went over to Mississippi State. The first person I met when I went to Mississippi was Aaron Henry. But I didn't go to stay. I went to get Avenue out of jail. I was a student at Morehouse, and we had the Atlanta student movement was the only movement in the country with any money. And Avenue got put in jail over there. And he was still at in college up there in Michigan. He came down to bring some pharmaceuticals right. to movement down there and got locked up. And we put the money up to get him out of jail. I went over there and put the money up to get him out of jail. That's when I met Aaron Henry at that time. There were several people like that in Mississippi who were like sort of bigger than life. They stood out because they were activists. Everybody knew it. They were involved in all the protests. And there was somebody like that in almost every town. And we quickly became friends with them. And they quickly, we sort of became their legs and their mouths and their arms. And that was really our purpose, too, was to try to help them do what they were trying to do. And, you know, I think Henry has played a major role in that. Now, you know, he's done some things on a tactical basis from time to time that I didn't agree with. And, I think he's proven his stripes over the years. You know, there's no question about that. And he was certainly, in those days, a key person in Mississippi. It was in the Mississippi Delta. It was Aaron Henry and Amzie Moore. And those were the two really outstanding features. You could go down into other cities, Batesville, Robert Miles, and go over to, and this was before Fannie Lou and Joe Mack and that group. There were people like and Mr. Travis, Jimmy Travis's father, who was very active down there. And there were people like that, that everybody knew. The state knew them. The state FBI and GBI and local police, everybody knew that they were very active in the movement. And there was not a whole lot going on in those towns, so they didn't have a...
I'm not on tape, am I?
Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to let you know that Alexis Roberson, in that recreation, she said that Riverfest is going on every Saturday, 3 o'clock in June. She won't have anything to give us for that. She can get that. But no stage, no support system. All of her staff, you know, everything's going towards that. If you wanted to change the day, so I could try, you know, see if the feds can give us anything, if we can get anything.
I'll talk.
You'll take it.
I'll talk to her about that, okay? Thank you. I think Gavin's approved this. I mean, Aaron, you know, he's in the state legislature now, state senate down there now, right?
Yeah.
People change over the years. I think that there were times when people felt that he that he was not aggressive enough, that he was. But I think some of that is a function of age, one, and two. I think it's a function of something else too, which is that there were newer, younger people coming along, who were more militant than he was. They're more educated, better prepared, and they pushed at the edges in ways that Henry wouldn't do. And that's true everywhere. That's true here in politics. There are younger people out there who are willing to take more chances. They've got less to lose, more to gain, and that's the way it is. I mean, that's sort of the nature of this business that we're in. And I think that some of that happened down in Mississippi, fortunately for all of us. because, I mean, Aaron Henry, I'm talking about 25 years ago. Right. I mean, Aaron Henry was a fully grown adult when I was in Mississippi, so he must be in his 60s, late 60s by now. And, you know, he'd have to move over and have some new leadership and some new people come up under him. And those people are going to be more aggressive, and they're going to be more more talented. They're going to demand more. They're going to take. They're going to want to take over these offices. They're not going to. They're going to be less compromising in terms of their views, and they will. They probably for a long time are not going to be willing to play the backroom politics that a guy, an established person like Henry might be willing to play now. And I think that's really where people, that's the group that has tried to discredit him. But that's sort of the American way. I mean, that's how you get power in this country. You have to challenge the guy that's in power. And you got to challenge his ideas, and you got to take it away from him. It's like boxing. You know, you can't beat the champion by just getting in the ring. You got to beat it. And it's got to be clear to everybody that you've got a better program, a better idea, and that you are better able to articulate it. And I think that a lot of that is what's going on in Mississippi right now with Aaron Henry, and I think that's probably how he's, you know, some people are discrediting him because they just feel like he's maybe outlived his time, and you know, and you know, it's some of that may be true, but on the other hand, it's still, you know, you got to take it away from him. You got to beat the champ. You can't just get out there and say I'm the champ. And I think McLemore is finding some of that down in Mississippi too. That he is McLemore has been very involved in politics for a long time, and is sort of the resident intellectual and the resident critic of Mississippi politics. He's kind of the guru down there. And yet he's never held elective office. And it may be that you can't, I mean, he may have just missed the time. Timing is everything in his business. He may never get elected because he is identified enough with the old guard by now so that young people don't trust him that much. And there are younger people out there who've got more legs and they've got more education, as I said, and they've got more ideas. And they're willing to, they want the whole thing right now. And that's sort of the juice that keeps us all going. And so I look at it that way. It's, you know, I'm a little removed from it now. And I can be more objective, I think, in looking at it. But there was a... You know, I think Mississippi has come a long way. I think it's limited somewhat by the economics of the state. There's no question about that. And if you look at this city now, I mean, Washington went through this 15 years of really bad times and economy down, no job, no economic expansion, very little money to do any kind of social programs with. And now in the last 4 or 5 years, it's been on the upturn. And there's more money to be created and do things with here. It made life a lot better for politicians who created and who want to try to implement some social programs. And I think Mississippi has never had that. So it's been a struggle for power there now more than anything else because even if you got into power, there was very little there that you could use to implement social programs. And it happened during a time when the bulk of the black leadership developed down at a time when the economy of the country was turning down.
Right.
We went through high inflation and low, high unemployment. Federal government was cutting back on its commitment to all those social programs.
People can't deliver like usually can't deliver.
Yeah,
that's
right.
The economy is just so desperate. It's just,
yeah.
The thing that really is noticeable to me in talking down there is, like in North Carolina, we had a rainbow community for some theater kids there. And Sanford just really beat it badly. And I just don't think that would have happened in Mississippi. I think there's an element, and there's more, somehow there's more class consciousness among blacks in Mississippi and North Carolina. Because, I mean, in North Carolina, what happened was whether you voted for Kinney or whether you voted for Sanders, on some levels was a class question, was that the sort of middle class traditional black organizations really turned out for Sanford. And McLemore, I mean, now even gotten some hostility, people sort of just sort of feel it toward him, that he sort of, because nobody had any know, and that just keeps sort of like the intellectual on campus.
Yeah.
He's forgotten his people. I mean, it's such a trap for him, you know, and I can't see any way out of it.
Yeah, I think it would be difficult for him to get elected office. But you got to remember something now about voting in most places, and I bet this is true of Mississippi now. It's the rock, real, church-going, middle-class, educated black who votes, the same way it's true in the white community. And you can turn that into votes, but you got to be capable of articulating something that they want. And that is not, that's not always easy to do. But I think that, you know, I actually went to a meeting of the Democratic Party in McDonough, a caucus of a political precinct, where he was trying to get elected precinct captain, which he did not accomplish. But, and that's like the elementary level of politics,
right.
You know.
Right.
And I was impressed that even there was some old line guy who was involved in the funeral home business, sort of typical, you know, who'd been the captain for a long time, he would be elected. But I mean, you know, with a little bit of thought and planning and a little, you know, I'm sure Matt could have pulled it off, because it was a matter of organizing. And you'd have to go in and do a little work before the actual day of the vote,
right.
Pull it off, but it could be done, because the numbers were so low and so small, and anybody could have, you know, who wanted to, could have spent a lot of time done it. But on the other hand, you can't keep losing these damn things, little things and other things, and build a reputation for yourself as being somebody who can win and who has some capability. that I think that's a big part of the problem. That I know from just a, okay.